Governor Doug Ducey is proposing changes to the state's Medicaid program, including a lifetime cap and co-pays. Some critics can't believe it.
We believe that these proposed changes actually run directly counter to that goal of providing opportunity for all.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, a strategy for rehabbing land affected by wildfire using tech developed in Tempe to improve police officer training.
A handful of grocery stores will be checking out of the valley.
And do sanctuary cities actually protect?
Typically, if it's somebody that's a violent criminal, the city is not protecting this particular person. It's more of a symbolic sort of term that is placed on cities as more welcoming toward immigrants.
Plus, the powerful punch of beer on the economy, and we hit the links with a champ.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. Quickly checking Valley traffic. I-17 southbound, an accident at Thunderbird, one on I-10 eastbound at 16th Street. It'll be sunny for the rest of the day. Very slight chance for some storms with a high of 104. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-80s. Right now, under mostly sunny skies, it's 102 degrees.
It's a big weekend in Mesa. Arizona's third largest city officially opens its new light rail extension Saturday. And as KJZZ's Phil Latzman tells us, leaders say it marks a huge milestone.
For Mayor John Giles, it's been a long time coming.
For me, I'm a Mesa native, and I remember coming to downtown Mesa, you know, back in the 60s when I was a little boy, and this was a hustling, bustling place. You know, it was the center of the East Valley's economy.
Giles says freeways and shopping malls slowly siphoned that business away. He admits the three-year construction project was tough on businesses, but promises completion of the Valley Metro's new Central Mesa extension will help downtown return to its former glory.
Bringing a train right down the middle of Main Street through this very authentic, historic downtown area that we have and right in front of our art center and a lot of other great resources we have down here is really a game changer for downtown Mesa.
The Mesa connection was completed 7 months ahead of schedule and is not the end of the line. The Valley Metro Light Rail will eventually extend another 2 miles along Main Street out to Gilbert Road. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Governor Doug Ducey is looking to modify the state's Medicaid program, the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, or ACCESS. The proposal, called Access Care, would require certain enrollees to make contributions to an account that could be used for services not currently covered by Medicaid. Tom Betlock, director of Access, says the plan makes sense.
The adult population is a relatively new population for Medicaid, and I think the governor's program is right on in that it wants to engage this new coverage group in looking at opportunities in terms of building better health and then also building in some incentives for work as well. And so I think the timing is right.
Betlock says the federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have approved similar changes in other states.
Indiana recently received the authority to establish health savings account. Michigan put some incentives in place as part of their 1115. And so we've seen instances where CMS has granted authority like this.
But critics of the governor's proposal say the changes to Arizona's Medicaid program would hurt recipients more than help them. Sam Richard is executive director of PAFCO, Protecting Arizona's Family Coalition.
We have a lot of agreements in the sense that both the governor and many in the health and human service community want opportunity for all. Everyone deserves dignity to find work and meaningful work at that. But we do have serious concerns about the way the governor is going about that, especially as it relates to some of the proposed changes to access.
In what ways do you have concerns?
So right off the bat, the upwards of 5% of income going to a combination of premiums and co-pays is concerning. These are people that are dealing with access to healthy food, access to safe housing, access to childcare. So adding another expense on top of this is actually what we avoided when we expanded Medicaid last summer and really worked to make sure that a whole new population of people had access to quality health care. We are also extremely concerned about the five-year lifetime limit. This is absolutely unnecessary and really shows an ignorance to the realities of people experiencing poverty. And in addition, another big piece of concern is the elimination of NEMT, or what's known as non-emergency medical transportation. So this is how people experiencing poverty or with other barriers to transportation get to appointments like dialysis or behavioral health appointments, and eliminating that necessary transportation for people experiencing poverty is completely unnecessary.
So given the fact that you say that you share the governor's ultimate goal in proposing these changes, are there other things that you would suggest doing that would reach them and maybe not cause as much pain to some of the recipients as you think what the governor's proposals would do?
When I say that we share those values, we share the values of opportunity for all and other similar values. We believe that these proposed changes actually run directly counter to that goal of providing opportunity for all. And we believe that actually making further investments in preventative health care, in access to health care, in other important programs like the child care voucher program or even the SNAP program, those programs go a long way in helping people achieve independence and permanence. And that's what both we want and the governor wants. No one who is experiencing poverty wants to stay in that experience. And with the right investments in prevention programs and services, we can really help people achieve that independence and permanence for the long term.
Do you have a gut feeling as to ultimately what's going to happen with this?
There have been 5 states across all 50 that have been approved some changes to their Medicaid programs. Much of what is in the governor's proposal here goes far beyond those programs. So we are hopeful that the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services will deny those portions of it. And we will work extremely hard to make the case that this proposal adds barriers to people experiencing poverty and for those who want to access quality health care.
Sam Richard is Executive Director of PAFCO, the Protecting Arizona's Family Coalition. Sam, thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mark.
This week, the Bureau of Land Management unveiled a strategy for revegetating areas affected by wildfires and other natural disasters. The National Seed Strategy involves 12 federal agencies and other non-federal partners. Peggy Olwell is the BLM's Plant Conservation Program Lead.
What we're trying to do with this strategy is to develop the materials and the network of growers and the network of facilities so that we will have material available that is the appropriate genetic material for restoring the native plant communities there out in the West.
Is there sort of a sweet spot as to timing of this? I mean, is there a time where it's too soon or a time by which you sort of miss the window to plant this?
Yes. It's like gardening. You have to have the right seed in the right place at the right time. And there's a lot of variables that come into play when you're gardening, and there's a lot of variables that come into play when you're putting seed out on the ground. And some of those we can control, and some of those we can't control. The weather is the one that we can't control so well.
Is there more to it than just trying to replace what was burned and basically put the same kind of vegetation in there that was there before the fire?
It depends upon what was there before the fire. In many cases, we've got lands that have been overtaken by invasives, which are your non-native species that have come in and taken over. And if those are there, that's certainly not what we want to promote or replant. And so, you know, it may take a couple of years before you can really get back to the native species, but that's what we're attempting to get back the materials and develop the materials to get back the native plant communities that were there historically.
Do you have the plants and the seeds ready to do this?
It depends on where the fires are, but the very first thing that we're going to be doing is to do an assessment of all of the federal agencies that deal with native plant materials or seed, and figure out what facilities they have, what capacity they have, what amount of land they might have, where they can help us research what we need to know about these things to get the materials out to farmers and growers. So when you ask if we have the seed, we have millions of pounds of seed in our seed storage facilities right now. Whether we have the material that we need for a particular fire is questionable depending upon where it is. Plants, even though they might be the same species, they differ genetically from one population to the next. And because of that difference, these species or these plants have evolved for the location where they occur.
Does the fact that, you know, we're in this historic drought and it's, you know, we've seen these big wildfires, not just in Arizona, but throughout the West, in some ways, does that sort of highlight the need for a program like what you're doing now?
I think all of these events, whether you're living in the desert with the extreme drought and extreme wildfires, or you're living on the coastline where we've got hurricanes, across the United States, we are looking at extreme weather events from climate change that are only going to increase, and they're going to increase our need for the seed materials. So the answer to your question is yes, and the timing is such that people are really understanding it.
Peggy Olwell is the Plant Conservation Program Lead for the Bureau of Land Management. This week, the agency unveiled its National Seed Strategy for Restoration of Land After Wildfires and Other Natural Disasters. Coming up, a shocker in the state's competitive grocery market industry.
Hagen's closing 5 of its 10 Arizona stores within approximately half a year of opening them. It's one of the biggest surprises in the supermarket sector, certainly in Arizona and across America within the last 20 to 25 years.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. You're listening to 91.5 KJZZ. Looks like the afternoon commute has gotten started a little bit early. Watch out for accidents 101 eastbound at 75th Avenue, which is restricting the off-ramp. Also I-17 southbound at Thunderbird, and the shoulders blocked by an accident on the 60 eastbound at McClintock. There's a slight chance for rain and blowing dust this evening around the valley. Look for overnight lows to be in the mid-80s. And then for this weekend, partly cloudy skies both Saturday and Sunday with a chance for showers both afternoons. Currently, relative humidity is at 29%. The dew point temperature is up to 65. It's partly cloudy and 102 degrees at 216.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, presenting the new 2016 Subaru Legacy, the 36 mpg midsize sedan redefined. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
This kind of scenario has played out too often across the country these days.
Hands up! Now! Shots fired! Shots fired!
Cops in a tense situation reacting in ways that end up with a suspect dead. As the police face increased scrutiny about their use of force in America, many departments are looking at ways to improve their training programs. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports.
For decades, police departments relied on instructional videos like this one.
The shotgun doesn't have to be aimed carefully. When there's no time to aim, you can whirl, fire, and blow the guy away.
Paired with firearms practice at the range, that was basic training for new recruits on the use of deadly force. The advent of single-screen simulators dramatically increased the efficiency of training, yet still fell short of recreating the real-world situations officers are faced with. But a company in Tempe has developed what police trainers call a game changer. Virtua Systems began as a company that developed entertainment simulators. Think arcade games with wraparound screens and surround sound. But over the past 10 years, they've set their sights on a new market, developing training simulators for police and the military.
We call it the V300. This is our flagship system.
Scott DiUlo, a former police officer, develops training content for Virtua.
This system is all about decision-making and judgmental use of force.
We're standing on a rumbling platform in the middle of an office building surrounded by 5 projection screens providing 300 degrees of video and speakers that produce immersive, high-fidelity sound effects. It looks like the most advanced first-person shooter video game I've ever seen, but this is no game. I'm armed with a real Glock 22 that's modified to simulate actual recoil. and I'm wearing what Virtra calls a threat fire device, basically a taser that will shock me if I'm shot in the simulation. Diula leads me through an active shooter scenario at a high school. Frightened children run all around us while multiple gunmen appear seemingly out of nowhere. I'm forced to distinguish between threats and hostages in split seconds. It's messy and chaotic. I move from the cafeteria through the halls and finally into the library, clearing the school of danger.
So right now I'm sweating profusely. My heart rate's elevated and I believe I was shot.
My adrenaline was running so high I almost didn't feel the electric shock. But it has a huge psychological impact.
The officers dread it, they don't like it, but it tells them, hey, there's consequences to you not doing something that you should.
That's Officer Danny King, a trainer at the Henderson Police Department outside Las Vegas. He says the interactive nature of the Virtra simulator, especially that threat fire device, is very effective on rookies and veterans alike.
Officers put something on the line. You know, if I just put a flat screen on a wall and have officers stand in front of it, and there's no feedback, there's no consequence to their inaction, then you're limited to what the response will be.
King says value only comes from a simulation when it really puts the officer in a different state of mind, so they can have the experience the first time in the trainer instead of the field.
And before our officers get to that point, we want them to be under stress. We want them to feel what feels like gas in their veins. And we want them to feel their pulse quicken and their respirations go up.
So with grant money from the Department of Justice, King's department purchased a Virtra simulator for close to $275,000. The company says hundreds are in use by police across the globe. King says one major advantage is the ability to play back the officer's performance and to alter the scenarios as they go through them.
We can stop the scenario and we can sculpt it and then we can put it in again. And see, you can't do that in the real world. When you're doing it in the real world, it's the real world.
Bo Cronin is a neuroscientist researching the effects of virtual reality on the brain. He says immersive simulations impact cognition much in the same way as actual experiences.
Multisensory and multimodal experiences are far, far more powerful than, for example, purely visual ones.
New connections are made between neurons in the brain as if the simulation actually happened, something called episodic memory.
But the interesting thing about simulations is that they also have a lot to do with our perceptual memory.
So even if a young recruit has never been in a deadly force situation before, if they experience one in a simulation, the brain will remember it when it happens in real life and act accordingly. And trainers like Danny King say that leads to better judgment and performance in the field. As part of the training, they also send recruits out to work the streets.
And when you put those things together, then you're making a good problem solver who can handle stress under the worst of conditions.
So hopefully, when cops feel that gas in their veins, they'll be less likely to panic and more likely to make the right decisions. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona is losing grocery stores. The Bellingham, Washington-based Hagen is closing 5 of its 10 stores in the state, one of which is in the Valley. This comes just a few months after the company came into the market, after it acquired some of the stores the Federal Trade Commission ordered Albertsons and Safeway to sell after their merger. For the whys and hows, we turn to Bert Flickinger III. He's managing director of Strategic Resource Group, a consumer industry consultancy which specializes in retail. And Bert, what do you make of all this?
Hagen's closing 5 of its 10 Arizona stores within approximately half a year of opening them is one of the biggest surprises in the supermarket sector, certainly in Arizona and across America within the last 20 to 25 years.
How so?
Even though Arizona has probably had the close to the U.S. record for most supermarket chains filing for bankruptcy during the last 25 years, and while Hagen's is still continuing to operate, the contraction and the drop down is much more severe with Hagen's than it was for Mega Foods, than it was for AJ Bayless, than it was for Southwest Supermarkets, than it was for Abco, number of other retailers across the state and Southwest who had contracted quite significantly, some of which contracted into bankruptcy and or liquidation.
So what happened to Hagen's and what happened to the company so quickly?
It looks looks like the Hagen stores are very popular in the Seattle, Olympia, Washington State areas. But for Hagen's to convert Albertsons and then convert Safeway without a big marketing budget, that became difficult to connect with consumers, particularly in Arizona and in Southern California, where the food retail competition is so relentless.
So is this just a matter of there being too many other choices in the Phoenix area and Hagen not being able to compete with that?
There are other choices in the Phoenix area, but in analyzing Hagen's weekly ads, Hagen's doesn't have the depth and range of grocery frozen food and dairy and meat and prepared food and produce items in its weekly ad that Fry's has.
Given that Hagen's wasn't open for very long in this state, will its departure from these stores mean much for the overall industry here?
The departure of the Hagen stores just opens the door for other very highly capable, well-capitalized competitors to expand. It opens the door for Whole Foods to expand more. Hagen's was certainly targeting Whole Foods. It opens the door for Trader Joe's. The Fry's stores in Flagstaff as well as Phoenix have picked up significant sales at Hagen's expense when Hagen's converted former Albertsons stores. Walmart will get some of the business, as will Winco. So with Arizona's population growing and Arizona's income growing, there's more business. But with more business, the greater Phoenix and statewide Arizona marketplace has become one of the most competitive in America.
Was there anything about the timing of the announcement of these stores closing that was surprising to you?
The timing of the closing announcement of the stores was really shocking, particularly in maybe not understanding the Arizona market from Seattle Hagen's corporate headquarters as they should. The stores, and in my professional view, the stores should have stayed open to when the U of A and ASU and other students came back, when the winter residents came back, because the stores between Labor Day and New Year's Day can make 40% to 50% of their annual profits and have significantly higher sales. So to close the stores in the high heat of the summer season when the volume's the lowest and the losses are the deepest and miss the opportunity to profitably increase sales and market share in the fall and winter months was a real surprise, particularly since it's well known in the supermarket sector that the closer you get to OND, October, November, December, as well as JFM, Jan, Feb, March, is the time to make money. And it seems like Hagen's may not have given the good people in their stores sufficient time to make the kind of money they could have.
Bert Flickinger III is Managing Director of Strategic Resource Group, a consumer industry consultancy specializing in retail. Students are generally moved in and classes are coming back into session at colleges and universities across Arizona. For some students, it's a whole new world. Cesar Calderon is one of them. He starts classes next week at Mesa Community College. The 26-year-old graduated from Mesa High in 2012 but wasn't able to afford higher ed until a judge upheld a policy making some undocumented immigrants under the Obama administration's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program eligible for in-state tuition at the Maricopa Community Colleges. Calderon is originally from Mexico, but has lived in Mesa for 20 years.
I'm excited. I'm stoked. This has been something I've wanted to do ever since I graduated from high school.
Was it just not financially feasible for you to go to MCC before this?
Yes, that's very correct. I'm handicapped, so getting the funds is very difficult for me. I'm unable to find a job because of my disability. To work where I want to work, I need an education. And to get an education, I need a job. So it's a vicious cycle.
What do you plan to study?
I'm studying journalism.
And am I right that after you get your associate's degree, you want to transfer to ASU?
That is correct.
Are you concerned about the fact that the legal battle over the fact that you can get in-state tuition is not over yet?
Well, yeah, that gets me a little bit worried because if in-state is taken away from me, it's going to be impossible for me. Going to be another struggle that I would preferably avoid.
If your in-state tuition gets taken away, yes. would you have to drop out?
I would have no other choice but to drop out.
What does it mean for you and for your family that you're able to get higher education now?
I'm the very first graduate of high school.
In your family?
Yes. My mother only reached elementary school. My father, he had no education. So I'm the very first generation to graduate. My mother, she's very proud of me. I have four brothers who look up to me, and I want them to follow my footsteps. I want them to know that if I can do it, they can do it.
Cesar Calderon will be starting his first semester at Mesa Community College. He's a recipient of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. Cesar, thank you, and good luck at school.
Thank you.
And KJZZ is licensed to the Maricopa County Community College District.
On the golf course, plenty of us have a slice problem or a putting issue or the sun gets in our eyes. 17-year-old Hannah O'Sullivan appears not to have any of those problems. She just won the U.S. Women's Amateur Tournament in Portland, Oregon, and says it felt incredible.
It was a very intense match out there. I just try to take it one shot at a time and kind of push aside winning from my mind as I'm playing. I just try to stay present, and to come out with a win and to be able to hold up the trophy, it meant so much, and I was very grateful.
What do you think makes the difference for you? Because a lot of people, well, people like myself, who are much older than you and have kind of a problem with the mental aspect of the game, how do you keep yourself so in tune, knowing that you have the physical tools, but also you can keep yourself in tune mentally?
The mental game is probably one of the strongest parts of my game. And I think mostly through experience, competitive experience. I've been playing junior golf and competitive golf for a very long time. So I've experienced both the ups and downs. So through my past experiences, I've been able to learn and grow and try and improve my mental game.
When did it start to become a real passion for you?
Well, I first started playing when I was about 6 years old because I actually loved mini golf as a kid. So and I was trying out all different kinds of sports. So my parents decided, why don't you try real golf? And I did, and I fell in love with it. I first started playing in little junior events when I was 8, and I just love the competition, and I think I would say I'm a very competitive person.
You're talking to a man in his 40s who struggles with the game of golf. If you could give me one tip, mental or physical, what would it be?
Stay patient and keep at it. I think that was one of the biggest things for me last week. I just had to stay patient. I mean, golf is a tough game. You're not going to play perfect golf. You're going to miss some shots, but it's whoever manages those mistakes and stays patient and fights through it that you'll see results in continually improve, I think.
17-year-old golf champion Hannah O'Sullivan of Chandler. She won the U.S. Women's Amateur. Hannah, thanks so much for the time.
All right. Thank you very much.
Coming up on the show, a new industry is brewing in Arizona.
We're a nice mix between a public place, a town hall, and we're at the roots of bringing back manufacturing.
We look at the impact of craft beer on the economy, that and more just ahead.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. He's Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Checking Valley traffic on the 60 eastbound. The right lane at McClintock is blocked by a crash. Elsewhere, I-10 eastbound at 67th Avenue, an accident. And I-17 southbound at Thunderbird. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Very slight chance of some storms. We're looking for a high of 104, which is also the average high for today. Clear skies tonight. Slight chance of storms again with overnight lows in the mid-80s. And partly sunny skies for the weekend. Still a slight chance of storms. 20 to 30% chance for both tomorrow and Sunday. A high of 104 tomorrow, 106 on Sunday. Right now in Phoenix, it's 102 degrees at 233.
KJZZ is supported by El Choro, Paradise Valley's historic destination dining experience. You can enjoy cocktails, seasonal cuisine, and patio views of Camelback Mountain. Details at elchoro.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has closed at its lowest level since the start of the year, tumbling 358 points today. That's about a 2% loss. Analysts say investors are worried that a slowdown in the growth of China's economy may signal slower global growth. Cal State University economist Sungwon Song.
Chinese economy is slowing more rapidly than many people anticipated. Government wanted economic growth rate in the range of about 7%. It looks like it might actually fall below 7%, which is a serious problem for China.
And Son says for the U.S. as well, because China's problems are creating more volatility on Wall Street. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has resigned and is calling for new elections in a move aimed at winning support for his handling of the country's latest bailout plan with European creditors. John Syropoulos reports it was just 7 months ago that Tsipras rose to power.
Alexis Tsipras says he has exhausted the limits of January's popular mandate. He is asking the Greek people to renew it if they judge that the bailout loan he got from the country's creditors last month, on condition that he implement strict austerity measures, is in the country's interests. Recent opinion polls show his left-wing Syriza party enjoying double the approval rates of the opposition conservatives he unseated. This despite Syriza's about turn from its election promise to stop austerity. Syriza came to power with 36% of the vote and rules with a coalition partner. The most auspicious polls suggest it could now win re-election with broad enough support to rule alone. For NPR News, I'm John Syropoulos in Athens.
President Obama says he and First Lady Michelle Obama are praying for former President Jimmy Carter as he undergoes radiation treatment for 4 small spots of melanoma on his brain. Carter says the cancer, which was first discovered in his liver, was recently detected on his brain. This is NPR News from Washington.
In the wake of the killing of a young woman in San Francisco by an undocumented immigrant, the term sanctuary city has returned to the headlines. It's also been a target of some of the GOP presidential candidates. So we decided to ask Lisa Magana, associate professor in the School of Transborder Studies at ASU, to help us learn what sanctuary city actually means.
Some cities have deemed themselves sanctuary cities. And the idea behind it is that immigrants that are in the city would feel safe to call the police if they were in trouble. And we have, I believe, 4 in Arizona that are sanctuary cities. And the idea was, again, that police didn't want to hurt relations between, say, Latino immigrants and police. So, for example, Phoenix is a sanctuary city. However, for Arizona, SB 1070 has trumped whatever that means to be a sanctuary city, because police, as a result of SB 1070, if in fact there's probable cause, can ask whether or not a person is an immigrant or in the country illegally, or what is their status.
At its core, when sanctuary city is used and it's effective, what are its most positive aspects?
Well, there was a recent case. It was a church, as a matter of fact, here in Tempe, that an immigrant was going to, in fact, be deported. And the church took him in and allowed him to live there, because churches actually are often places, sanctuary places. Mm-hmm. And there's been a long history of churches, and the Catholic Church, for example, this was a Presbyterian one, but having a long history of protecting immigrants or working with immigrants. And eventually, he was able to leave because of DACA, the Deferred Action Program, that this particular immigrant would be able to apply under DACA and subsequently not be deported.
Many people will use sanctuary cities as a pejorative, as if any crime, any violent crime committed by an undocumented immigrant is all of a sudden because this city's policy allowed this to happen. It's obviously much more complicated than that, but is there any connection there?
I don't think so. And I think it's more symbolic that cities in the past have deemed themselves sanctuary cities to show that this is a place that's safe and that it's welcoming of immigrants, and certainly has much to do with the climate of the time in terms of when these types of laws are passed. However, typically, if it's somebody that's a violent criminal, the city is not protecting this particular person. Again, it's more of a symbolic sort of term that is placed on cities as more welcoming toward immigrants.
We're hearing a lot of words from some controversial folks like Donald Trump and also those who would seem less controversial, someone like Jeb Bush. They're making a lot of noise about this. How much do politicians like to take advantage of headlines like this, again, like the one in San Francisco?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, that was such a rare case, this person that he was apparently deported and come back and then had sadly killed this beautiful young woman. It wasn't necessarily the fault of the city because it was a sanctuary city. And from my understanding, it had much to do with the police and keeping track of this particular person, not necessarily so much the immigration system. But in terms of most recently, you know, some of these proposals that are coming out are so much more symbolic than substantive. So, for example, the idea of the big wall or creating a big wall that Mexico would have to pay for. Donald Trump's proposal, so much more symbolic.
Lisa, we've been talking about the sanctuary cities, but I wonder when it comes down to local law enforcement, how much influence does the actual practice of local law enforcement? There's 287G, some of our listeners would have heard about that, basically because the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office didn't actually follow what the federal government wanted them to do. But what do individual cities, individual communities, local law enforcement, how much can they actually determine whether a city acts as a sanctuary city?
Right. That's such a great question. And I think that police in many ways have more of an impact in terms of being a sanctuary atmosphere, sanctuary city, than a city actually being deemed a sanctuary city. And what I mean by that is that police will choose to not enforce immigration activities. And so a good example, Los Angeles is a very famous sanctuary city, and they have what's called Special Order 40. And the idea is that LAPD is not allowed to work with, say, for example, Border Patrol or ICE. And the idea is that if a immigrant is afraid to call the police, he or she may not, for fear of deportation. Now, here in Arizona, you know, again, SB 1070 trumps this. But there are cities that police that have their own sort of culture, organizational style, where they choose not to carry out immigration activities, specifically because they want to keep and retain good relations with the Latino population. Again, every city's different. You know, Tucson has a very different climate than, say, for example, Phoenix.
Lisa Magana is associate professor in the School of Transborder Studies at ASU. Lisa, thanks for your insights.
It was my pleasure.
Amidst a recently up and down stock market, the Dow lost 500 points today. There's this: Arizonans are not saving enough money to guarantee a secure retirement. So says a report from the National Institute on Retirement Security, which found fewer than 40% of private sector workers in the state contribute to a retirement plan through work. To get a sense of what that means for retirees, we call on Doug Hart. He's president of the Arizona Alliance for Retired Americans. And Doug, what do you make of these results?
Well, obviously, it puts a huge burden on seniors and retirees. They just simply have not, for whatever reason, been able to save enough for retirement. And so as a consequence, most of them are having to find a job in their retirement to survive.
Are you finding that among your members?
Somewhat, although our generation members, because we're retired now, tended to have pensions more so. The number of defined benefit pensions has been cut in half in the last 10 years in this country.
Did these results surprise you at all?
Actually, they did a little bit.
In what way?
Well, because we were always taught that Social Security is part of a three-legged stool to retire on. And one is savings, one is Social Security, and one is your pension. And when people don't have pensions, you would think that they would try to make attempts to save more. The problem is, I think, the real wages of this country have not kept pace with inflation even, and it's been very, very difficult to retire on anything but Social Security.
Is there something specific to Arizona that goes on with private sector workers that would lead them to be facing this situation when those in other states aren't dealing with this?
Well, as you know, it's not a very strong union state, so they don't have union contracts to protect them and provide some sort of retirement security. Also, the wage levels are here in Arizona are less, and the unemployment is a little higher. So if you combine those three, it's a little bit more difficult, even if you're retired and want to find work, to put everything together to make ends meet.
Do you think this is an issue of folks not thinking about setting up a 401k or saving for their retirement? Is it an issue of they don't have enough money left over from their paycheck to set it aside? Is there something else going on?
I think it's the latter. My own mother worked two jobs her whole life, waited tables, worked in offices, took in laundry even. My father died when I was young, and she wound up living the last 6 years of her life with us because her only income was Social Security. It was literally impossible for her to save anything for retirement. And I think there are millions and millions of people like that across the country.
Is there anything that can be done for current retirees who are facing this issue, or is it a matter of just teaching folks who are a little bit younger who will be retiring the next couple of years, hey, you need to figure this stuff out?
Well, yeah, I think there are some things. Obviously, education is one of them. We need portability of pensions so that people can move from job to job and take their accounts and pensions with them. We need to improve Social Security.
Is there a short-term solution to help folks who are retired now who are dealing with, you know, having less than $24,000 in their retirement savings accounts? Or I mean, I hate to say it, but is it too late?
Given the present political climate, yeah, it really is. There doesn't seem to be much of a willingness to, as there was in past generations, to corporately in this country share the responsibility. And it's always been an American value to take care of each other. And now it seems to be more of a, I've got mine, you get yours, too bad. And the wealthy that are funding the political process really don't have any appreciation or understanding of the problems facing everyday retirees.
Doug Hart is president of the Arizona Alliance for Retired Americans. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve. I'm Mark. The show is a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and stories from around the country. With the help of reporters and producers around the region and the globe, we're keeping you up to date and entertained.
Looks like we'll have partly cloudy skies tonight around the valley. There's a 20% chance for showers, and a dust storm's a possibility. Lows will be in the mid-80s. This weekend should be partly sunny, with highs of 104 tomorrow, 106 on Sunday, with a 20 to 30% chance of afternoon showers. Currently, relative humidity is at 29%, partly cloudy and 102 degrees at 2:45.
KJZZ is supported by the Grand Canyon Music Festival, 3 weekends through September 12th at Grand Canyon's South Rim. The Catalyst String Quartet, Sweet Plantain, Brooke Speltz, and the Bonfilio Group. GrandCanyonMusicFest.org.
A lot of people have turned away from local TV newscasts, sometimes because of frustration with the product, but also because they have countless other choices for where to get their news and information. But Spanish-speaking residents may be using the local newscasts in a different way.
Su celular ya no solo lo puede conectar con amigos y transportarlo hasta su lugar de origen, sino que también lo podría llevar directito a la cárcel, esto si la Corte Suprema del país permite que la policía tenga el derecho de confiscar su teléfono celular.
Telemundo Phoenix KTAZ says its 10 p.m. newscast has been the Valley's most watched late local newscast, regardless of language, among adults 18 to 49 for 4 consecutive months. Gustavo Arellano is the editor of OC Weekly, the man behind the Ask a Mexican column, and an observer of Spanish language media. Gustavo, what do you make of Telemundo's news ratings?
It's not surprising at all. Number one, you have that concentration of a Latino population, especially a Spanish-speaking one, that's really limited to just two choices, Univision, the Univision affiliate, or the Telemundo affiliate, as opposed to, say, the English language that has not just the four major networks, but then also local broadcast, cable, and whatnot. So everything is funneled into, you know, into either Univision or Telemundo. For me, what's surprising is Telemundo. Telemundo is always known as the junior brother to the Univision giant. And like usually, at least on a national level, the comparison is not even close. So it's very fascinating that in Phoenix, Telemundo is able to not only beat Univision, but to beat everyone else.
Is there a difference in style? Is there a difference in tone between Univision and Telemundo?
People always like to make fun of Spanish language news broadcasts for featuring very fat men and very buxom women. And hey, that's true, maybe. In most cases, it is. But what people don't want to pay attention to is what's actually being put on the broadcast. And a lot of times, local Spanish language network affiliates, they're going to have everything that media analysts say that mainstream media no longer does. Mm. In other words, they're going to put a huge emphasis on local issues. They're not necessarily objective, but rather trying to promote the Latino community. You know, everything from these are the bad politicians out there. These are the efforts, the community leaders that you should be paying attention to. This is what you should be doing for your children. So it's a really great combination of hard news, soft news, and more importantly, knowing who the audience is.
Do people who are from a Latino community who speak Spanish, do they use TV news any differently than the average English-speaking Anglo person?
Well, you're going to see with a Latino viewer who's mostly Spanish-speaking, so it's probably going to be an immigrant, they're going to rely on traditional media far more than an English speaker or even their own children who are assimilated in this country. So there's going to be more reliance on network television, on, non-cable broadcast. There's going to be more reliance on print to this day.
So, Gustavo, as Latino culture not just penetrates American society, but in many ways can dominate as we move forward, as we look for population shifts, demographic shifts, and whatnot. What other changes? I mean, I know the crystal ball is tough, but what other changes should we look for? Should we start to see more of a blend as the years go by between English and Spanish? Are we going to see more Spanish stuff? As you mentioned, having a Spanish language reporter, will that be more likely? Will that be more common?
I don't think the twain shall meet. In other words, I think English broadcasts are going to remain in English, Spanish broadcasts are going to remain in Spanish. About the most that'll happen is in an English language broadcast, they're going to see some Spanglish thrown in. Mm. So I don't think broadcasters have to explain what a gringo is anymore or what salsa is. In the Spanish language section, quite the opposite, actually. Spanish language understand that they are the ones who are losing audience members all the time as these Latinos and their children assimilate into American society. So especially in a lot of these community weeklies, you'll have an English language section specifically for young readers who are no longer as fluent in English as in Spanish as they were before. So we live in interesting times right now with so many Spanish language speakers, but that market will have to evolve more so than the English language market has to evolve.
Gustavo Arellano, he's the editor of OC Weekly and the man behind the Ask a Mexican column. The latest Beer Serves America study released by the Beer Institute and the National Beer Wholesalers Association indicates the drink and its production continue to tap into a significant part of the U.S. economy. According to the report, the beer industry contributes more than $252 billion in economic output. Rob Fulmer, executive director of the Arizona Craft Beer Association, says the impact of brew on the state is similar to the rest of the country.
We're following national trends. A couple years ago, we had 30 breweries. Last year, at this time, almost exactly, we had 50, and I said we hit 75 by today, and we hit 74. So the number of breweries is growing, and also the amount of beer that we're producing, the market share that we're getting is growing as well.
And so when you're producing it because people are interested in buying it. What's making the difference there?
I've been in the knowledge-based industries, computer science and things like that, and a lot of people have consulting jobs or really don't have that physical, that sense that things are beginning and ending. And part of the thing that happens is you get home brewers because they like to be able to produce things, and it's kind of like when people go back to the kitchen and they want to get hands-on, they want to entertain. It's all part of that sort of movement. I think people like to be able to see the person that brews their beer, look them in the eye, ask them a question, have a beer with them. And they like to see, that stainless steel. We're a nice mix between a public place, a town hall, and, we're at the roots of bringing back manufacturing in a weird and interesting way because we're really inefficient at it. We throw a lot of labor at it.
Do people make a career out of this? How tough is it to make a career out of it?
It is difficult to transition because it is, it has the same kind of labor of love as a restaurant or any of those types of industries. You can definitely make a career out of it. There are, for every one brewery job, studies show there's 30 to 40 jobs downstream that are a result of that brewer making beer. So those would be in your hospitality industries, servers and distributors and salespeople and truck drivers and people who make the equipment and the packaging. We've got some of those people actually here in Phoenix that build pieces and parts for breweries.
How have craft brewers changed the overall industry? Is there a feeling that the big boys see this as competition?
The bigger breweries like Bud Miller and Coors, and they're hedging their bets with us. We use their distribution channels. They are either emulating our products, or they are purchasing those breweries, or they are investing in those breweries. So overall, their market share is declining. They still outweigh us tremendously in volume, and I think they're just kind of they're playing the odds. They're putting a little bit of investment in us, and they're just keeping an eye on what market growth is.
You mentioned sort of the Arizona growth is pretty similar to the national pattern. Is there anything though that unique that we should know about it? Is there some aspect of brewing here that has sort of taken off in a little different direction?
Sure. Right now, craft beer is seeing about a 16% growth, and we're right in that ballpark. We might actually be a little bit ahead of that. The thing about beer is, and the beer industry is, it kind of maps to geography in a lot of ways, and we're kind of unique as a state. We have a very large metro area, and we have two other slightly smaller metro areas, and if you want to throw Lake Havasu and Prescott in there, those are your beer locations right now. Tucson, Flagstaff. We're not like Colorado, where there might be a mining town of 5,000, and they might have 200 or 300 of those. We don't have that, and we don't. So, there again, beer is really inefficient. So they can have some of these really small operations that'll employ 10, 12, 15 people. We're kind of mapped to this geography, and the whole state is not desert, but this is a brutal part of the state, and our water is alkaline and it needs to be treated. Other parts, they can take it right out of the ground and use it for brewing. So there are some challenges, but we have a lot of assets. We've got good infrastructure, good city streets, highways to move things around. So it's beer adapts to us, and we kind of adapt to beer.
Rob Fulmer, we've been talking about craft brewing and the beer industry in Arizona. Rob, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This venue has been a gathering place for decades. As a matter of fact, it was an entertainment spot even before Arizona was a state. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us there.
Arizona State Fairgrounds hosts numerous events every year, including the state fair. Did you know the fairgrounds has been hosting the annual event since 1905?
It was used as the territorial fair until 1911, and then 1912 it switched over to the state fair.
Gigi George is a resident of the Encano-Palmcroft area. It's a community east of the fairgrounds. She's also writing a book about the place and takes me on a stroll around the area.
This represented the bounty of the state of Arizona, where they showed it off every October, every November.
The gathering showcased and celebrated the accomplishments of the territory's agriculture and livestock industry. The original fairgrounds in the 1880s was located near Central Avenue in the Salt River. When the river flooded in 1891, the area was washed out, so the gathering ended. After several years, Phoenix Mayor John C. Adams decided to raise private funds to purchase an 80-acre property. It was way north of the city, in an area we know today as McDowell Road, 19th Avenue, and Grand Avenue. Adams wanted to revive the state fair and add horse racing.
He had had the forethought to have the legislature pass legislation in 1904 to permit this.
In 1905, the fair was up and running again. Structures were added to the land, including a wooden grandstand and a one-mile track for horse racing. Then auto racing was added. A few years later, additions were made to the property.
The mining interests in Arizona had that grandiose mining and mineral museum built in 1918. And that was the only one that really survived.
In the 1930s, a new concrete grandstand replaced the original wooden one that burned down. Cattle barns and other structures were added. One in particular is the WPA Civic Building. It was the Arizona headquarters of the Works Project Administration, the agency that oversaw the federal government's New Deal era program.
You can look at that 1938 building right there and say, this was the headquarters for the administration from the state and federal government that brought Arizona back to life.
Right now, the future of the WPA building is up in the air as state and city leaders and community representatives try to develop a plan and raise the funds to preserve it. Car racing on the Arizona State Fairgrounds ended in the 1960s, and part of the track was replaced with the Arizona Veterans Memorial Coliseum. Which, by the way, the Coliseum was known as the Madhouse on McDowell for the Phoenix Suns during the team's early years. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or just know something that we should know, please tell us about it. You can send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
If you've got some available time this weekend, we've got some ideas for how to spend that free time. Just a few days before the Phoenix Mercury will be honored at the White House, we'll be hosting a couple of games here in Phoenix. Tonight at 7 against the LA Sparks and on Sunday afternoon against the Minnesota Lynx.
If you want to see Steve Goldstein this weekend, you can check out Hello Kitty's Super Cute Friendship Festival. That's tonight and tomorrow at Gila River Arena. You've got some cats. I don't know if you say hello to them at all when you go home.
I do. I say hello to them all the time, of course. Class Clowns of Comedy tonight at 7:30 at the Tempe Center for the Arts. We failed that one, I think, didn't we?
I believe so, yes. Sadly, we did, yes. Also, you can check a Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. That'll be at the Herberger Theater Center.
Today's show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian, Tracy Greer, Sky Shab, Maria Springs of the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John, the peachy one, Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know good story ideas. We are at the show at kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Thanks so much for listening. All Things Considered is next. It's 3 o'clock.